Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein welcoming you to another of our Clubland Q&As live around the planet. It is 4 p.m. Eastern Time in North America. That means it's 5 p.m. in the Maritimes, 5:30 in Newfoundland, 6 p.m. in Bermuda. It's 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, which means for our European listeners that everything's an hour earlier than we normally do it, because we've sprung into summer, whereas you're still mired in the slough of despond of winter. So that's 9 p.m. In Europe, 10 p.m. in the Middle East, 11 p.m. if you're checking out of Vladimir Putin's victory party at the Kremlin a little early. It's kind of duller than you expected. Not enough dancing girls. Then we would love to hear from you. If you're a Mark Stein Club member anywhere around the world, India, Honkers, Australia, New Zealand, where it's a little, it's Wednesday morning already, do let us know. Our theme for today is, broadly speaking, identity politics, which basically the Democrats and in the United States, the Liberal Party in Canada, and many other political parties around the world have decided to bet the farm on. Michael Covino is first up. Hi, Mark. In my opinion, identity politics is the antithesis of the whole idea of America as a nation. If you're an American who practices and pushes it, then you cannot believe in the motto of this nation, a pluribus unum. Assimilation is the glue which binds us as citizens, especially since, unlike the Romans, Greeks, or English, our ancestors come from diverse places. The great thing about America is you can retain the traditions of your ancestors and their language, if you choose, without fear of retribution. Just look at the pride in the traditions of Irish Americans, Italian Americans, or Americans who are Jewish in maintaining and celebrating heritage rituals. What do you think of this idea? Is there similar thinking among Canadians, since their ancestors also came from different places? Looking forward to your thoughts. Well, Michael, you're right that the whole point about identity politics is to stop people thinking as individuals, as citizens equal before the law, but as members of groups who benefit from group rights. And you mentioned the American idea. Traditionally, all common law countries have generally been antipathetic to the idea of group rights. It's not something common law really places much emphasis on. Their point is that Smith or Jones stands in law as no different from any other citizen, equal before the law. And obviously, group rights is meant to undermine that. I was talking last night on Tucker, on Fox News, I was talking last night with Tucker about these list of microaggressions between the University of California in Santa Cruz publishes and expects its students to live by. And the microaggressions are getting super micro. For example, if you have a math problem that's a bit difficult for you, you're not meant to say, hey, you're Chinese, could you help me with this math question? Because that stereotypes the Chinese person as being gifted at math. It plays into the stereotype that if you've got some Chinese guys on your school math team, you're going to win all the competitions. And the stereotype happens to be true, actually. I was at my kid took part in this thing. What's it called? I think it's called Mathletes. They were playing, the local schools were all playing in a competition, a Mathletes competition held at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. So my kid and his team, they drive all the way down to Dartmouth. And there's kids there from various other local schools. And some of these schools had like two Asians on the team. And one school had no Asians on the team. And one school had all Asians on the team, plus an Asian math teacher. That was a private school. And my kid's school had one half Asian adopted person on the team. And it was actually hilarious to watch because it was all things like all the questions were like, if a train is proceeding toward the track, proceeding down the track at 212 miles an hour, and another train 1 and 7/8 miles away is proceeding down an adjacent track that will join the and then bzzz, and it would be the all Chinese team, and the guy would go 73, and it would be correct. And so, how the all Chinese team with the Chinese math teacher, they came first, and then the team with two Chinese members came second, and my kid's team, which had a half Chinese adopted child on the team, they came third, and the one with no Chinese people came fourth. So sometimes there is amazingly, you know, these stereotypes arise for a reason. And we used to know about these things. There used to be an old, what's the old European joke? You know, that in heaven, the British are the policemen and the French are the chefs and the Italians are the whatever. And then whereas in hell, the British are the chefs and the Germans are the policemen and whatever. We used to understand that there was some truth in these stereotypes. But now, at the same time as we are being asked to deny stereotypes, we are being asked to accept group identity as everything. So at the same point that you can't make generalizations about Chinese math skills or French culinary skills, you're being told that group identity is everything. And so these microaggressions at California, where you are allowed, you have to remember that you're not allowed to make supposition. If you meet a Chinese person, you shouldn't make assumptions about his skill at math. Whereas if you meet a black person, you shouldn't say to him, "Ah, that's extraordinary. You're really awfully good at math. I had no idea." Because that suggests that you expected he wouldn't be good at math. So in other words, they're trying to make basic social interactions all but impossible because you're tiptoeing around on eggshells all the time. Best not to talk to anyone. Best just to stay off in your own identity group corners and leave officialdom, whether it's the University of California at Santa Cruz or it's the government at a higher level, as the arbiter, as the sole arbiter and mediator of the various competing group rights. And that's the world we're going to be moving into. And it's an extremely disturbing world to be a part of. It's not going to be an agreeable world. It will be a world that, in a sense, it totally diminishes individual liberty is necessarily diminished. To go back to the Chinese again. No, I don't want to pick on the Chinese. Actually, they're incredibly discriminated against. They're discriminated against at American universities, for example, where they get the test scores to go to the best universities in the world. But all the universities actually affirmatively discriminate against Asian students at American universities. I should say, by the way, this is how complicated identity politics gets. When you say Asian in America, it normally means Chinese. When you say Asian in England, it usually is a polite euphemism for Pakistani Muslim grooming gangs who've been mass gang raping the English working class girls in the town since they were 9 years old or whatever. So, but I'll make another Chinese point. The case I mention always mention is the guy at Oldies Night in the pub on the Isle of Wight, and he was singing Kung Fu Fighting, which, as you know, is number one in Britain, 1974, number one America, 1974, number one Australia, big hit all over the world. And he was singing, there were funky China men from funky Chinatown, and an actual Chinaman, whether of the funky or non-funky persuasion, was passing the pub and heard this through the window and went to the police, and they arrested this guy on the grounds that a white man singing there were funky Chinamen from funky Chinatown is a hate crime. If an actual Chinaman, you're not meant to say Chinaman, but the song says Chinaman, so I'm going to say Chinaman. How many times have I said Chinaman? Chinatown, my Chinatown. No one sings that anymore. Lots of funky Chinamen in there. Not too funky. That's pre-funky Chinamen. Anyway, funky Chinamen. What was I talking about? Funky Chinamen in funky Chinatown. If you're Chinese, you can sing about funky Chinamen in funky Chinatown. But if you're a white guy and you sing funky Chinamen in funky Chinatown, that's a hate crime. It's not clear if you're the original singer, Carl Douglas, who had the first hit with that song, is from the British West Indies. He's black. So maybe he can sing Funky Chinamen from Funky Chinatown. And the producer of it is a guy from India, from the Indian subcontinent, Bidu, I think it was. And so you can, if you're Chinaman, you can sing about funky Chinaman from funky Chinatown. If you're a white guy, you can't sing funky Chinaman from funky Chinatown. If you're a black or brown guy, it's unclear. So different words are legitimate according to who is saying them. And that's what the University of California says, that if you can't say, for example, one of the things they say is you can't say to a black person, why are you getting so loud and angry? Because it stereotypes the black man as angry and loud. On my BBC show in the 90s, we had as a guest Ellis Coase, I think his name was, who was writing for Newsweek, and he'd written a book called Why Black People Tend to Shout. But if you actually meet a black person who talks in a loud voice, you're not to draw attention to it, because that's buying into the stereotype. So the idea is we should all be walking, whereas if a white person's talking loud, you're allowed to say, I say, would you mind piping down? There's no need for you to get all shouty. So if, say, it's Mark Levin and he happens to be getting excited on his radio show or whatever, you can say, oh, Mark Levin, would you mind piping down? But you can't do it if you meet if you're listening to some black guy on the radio and tell him to pipe. So the whole idea is that we all walk around on eggshells, and we require officialdom to set the rules of basic social interaction. And this is supposedly in the interest of sensitivity training. And I always quote Kathy Shadle's great line that actually what we need is insensitivity training. It's going to ruin society. It's going to lead to us all thinking tribally. Lindsay Shepherd said on the Mark Stein show, it's basically formalized ad hominem identity politics, because your statement has value and weight according to the group you belong to. If you, for example, opine on transgender issues, your opinion has value if you are transgendered, and has no value if you're some cis white male or whatever. So it will destroy everything. Charles Moritz, or Moritz, I don't know, I'm not sure how, whether the accent on the first or second syllable. Maybe Charles Moritz from Switzerland. Charles or Shao says, hi, Mark. It would seem to be human nature to want to belong to an in-group, but to do so, an out-group must be identified. Is there any way to reconcile this without trying to homogenize society? You're right here, Charlie. The proliferation of in-groups places ever more strains on the out-group, because there's really basically only one out-group at the moment, and that's straight cis white males. That's the absolute dud category to belong to, because no matter how few there are of you, you are to blame and you will always be to blame. And so in a couple of decades' time, there'll be one cis straight white male left. He'll be like 127 years old and everything will still be his fault. And that becomes more and more critical, even though there are obvious differences in the interest between some of the competing in-groups. I mean, for example, in the Netherlands, there are two in-groups. There's like the gay guys, and Netherlands is all hot for the gays, loves the gays, gay nightclubs, gay here. Amsterdam used to be one of the gayest cities on the planet. Then they moved in another in-group, Muslims. They're fantastic. Muslims celebrate diversity, religion of peace, Allahu Akbar. The Muslims and the gay guys don't get on. And so here we have a situation where the gay guys, when they want to make an example of somebody, they find a Christian baker and they say, we'd like you to bake us a big gay wedding cake and stick two bridegrooms on the top of it. And the Christian baker goes, well, I'm a bit uncomfortable about it. And then they sue the hell out of him and destroy the business. They never go to the Muslim bakery and say, hey, we're a couple of gay guys and we'd like you to do us a great big wedding baklava and put a couple of gay bridegrooms on the top of it. Because you'd have a whole other series of complications there. Likewise, the real strains of these competing in-groups will become clear when you want to put up a mosque next to the gay bathhouse. There are competing, we get an inkling of how that's going to turn out, though. For example, even in the Orlando nightclub thing, which is the biggest pile of gay corpses ever, this Muslim guy kills 50, targets explicitly a gay club. A Muslim kills 50 gays because homosexuality is an abomination to Islam. And the gay guys go, I've talked about this before, I don't want to go down too far this path, but they fold. They fold their tents just like the Arabs, and you don't hear a peep out of them about that. Because all these competing in-groups, for the moment, what matters is that the cis straight white male should remain the out-group. And the other point to understand about that is that at some point you have two phenomena. I mean, one of these things is that nobody wants to be in that group anymore. So people who are transparently white, for example, I'm not just thinking about Elizabeth Warren identifying as 132nd Cherokee, and that is more important to her than the 31st, I mean, which is fake, but that's as fake as it is, being 132nd Cherokee and being the whitest white since Frosty the Snowman fell in a vat of whiteout, as I always say, that's more important to her than the 31/32nds of her that aren't Cherokee. But you see it again when the New York Times hailed Penelope Cruz as being her presence at the Oscars as being a great breakthrough for women of color. She's Spanish. Spanish women are white European women. This idea that somehow because she's got a Spanish name, she's a person of color is completely stupid, even for the New York Times. She's not white. She's not a person of color. She's a person of non-color. She's a Spanish lady, the great imperialist who conquered Latin America. But she's presented by the New York Times as a great breakthrough for making the Oscars less white than they used to be. And so you're seeing this flight from white, where people define themselves by the part of them that isn't that. And you see it also in the fact that, and the flight from maleness, that 9 out of 10, for every person transitioning from female to male, there are 9 people transitioning from male to female. It's a great flight from maleness, flight from whiteness. And I think that's one phenomenon. The other phenomenon, of course, is that a guy like Trump has demonstrated, and I think there is some truth to that, that if everybody's a minority group, then eventually the people who don't fit into a minority group, like just depressed, broken down, blue collar white guys in crappy towns where the mills and the factories have closed, start to think like a minority group too. And then it's all just tribal. It's all just tribal. Andrew says, we've seen identity politics turn the left against itself. Gays against Muslims, white women against black women, trans women versus radical feminists. Do you think the identity politics movement will cannibalize itself out of existence? No, I don't think that is what's going to happen. I think people are very serious about inventing newer and newer categories, and that the subdivision of identity group categories is going to continue. The Islam thing is separate. That's what follows after this identity group phase. I mean, it's very striking to me, and I wrote about this as long ago as America Alone, I mean, which is now 12 years ago. I noticed this phenomenon when you have these stories about gay parenting. Jenny lives with Eric and Martin. And if you complain about that in your average school district in Canada or the United States, I think the one where it came up was somewhere in British Columbia. And the school board says, listen, you uptight white Christians, you just got to get with the program. This is the way it is. Jenny lives with Eric and Martin. We're going to teach it to your first grade kid, and you're just going to have to suck it up and like it. It came up in a school in Bristol, England, that had a mostly Muslim student body. And the first complaint from the Muslim parents that they didn't want their kids being taught Jenny lives with Eric and Martin, the school in Bristol, England, yanked it from the curriculum immediately, and not a peep from was heard out of it again. They took away Jenny lives with Eric and Martin and replaced it with Jenny lives with a big bearded imam who wants to and his child bride, and they want to marry her off to her cousin from Mirpur in Pakistan. And everyone likes that book, and so you don't hear a peep about it. So Islam, as we see in these horror stories from England, Islam is what comes after we've all indulged ourselves on the identity politics. Dear Mark, this is Eric McGeer. Dear Mark, a key point that emerged in your conversation with Lindsay Shepherd was the easy path of conformity that most academics choose to follow. This meshes with my experience over many years teaching at the university and high school level, during which I've never failed to be amazed at the sheer intellectual laziness of so many professors and teachers. They make the exceptions all the more honourable in my mind. I remember my dissertation advisor, a fine scholar and a gentleman, not a common combination, believe me, telling me that the one indication of intelligence he trusted was the students' ability to change their minds. The more they did that, the more they were thinking for themselves. Any fool can spout the postmodernist mumbo-jumbo, but subject that person to any serious cross-examination and his cover is blown. The lack of general knowledge and context, the inability to express oneself properly in one's own language, the stunted conformity and dullness of the academy add up to the sorry legacy of our school system. The sooner certified online courses begin to challenge the university, the better, since only the open market can break the hold of school and university staff and administrators whose shameless careerism and ideological obeisance have pretty much ruined higher education in the English-speaking world. You're absolutely right there, Eric. And that's why education is the biggest structural defect in our society, because, again, it's about identity. What does your education system do? I mean, it's interesting to me, for example, the number of jihadists, the number of ISIS volunteers from the United Kingdom, Belgium, France, Canada, Australia. These are people who've often have been born in the countries for which they hold passports, but have absolutely no connection with it. It's a travel document. It's not an expression of allegiance. It's a travel document. Their identity is other. And why would you expect it to be any different? These are people who have been raised in schools that teach them from day one that their nation, their culture, their civilization is the source of all the bad things on the planet. Racism, colonialism, imperialism, every ism, climate denialism, everything comes from these, the most successful civilization in the history of the planet. And they're taught from day one that it's absolutely worthless and responsible for all the ills of the planet. And so, if you happen to be, you know, some guy whose ancestors got off the Mayflower, you might just be kind of happy in the void. If you're not so happy, but you're a reasonably settled person, you'll look for an alternative allegiance. You'll get into social justice or climate change. But if those aren't strong enough meat for you, you'll look elsewhere for a primal identity, and you'll find Islam, and you'll find the jihad, and you'll go off for identity politics. Alan Miller says, I tried to see the bright side of things, so I think we're maybe missing a trick with this issue. It's not clear on the pecking order of identity politics that if you're a white male, or even if you're not a dark enough Hispanic like George Zimmerman, you're automatically far more guilty than any of the other groups. It's also clear that if you just say a word out of the currently fashionable political narrative, your life will be destroyed by means of abuse and doxing on social media. So why don't we just save a load of money, scrap all the courts and judiciary, and just let the people do trial by media instead? The legal system now seems to be totally superfluous to the punishment process. We could even bring back trial by witch dunking as well. Should we also legalize the rape of 11-year-old white girls by Pakistani Muslims, since that is now a normal part of life in vibrant, diverse British society? And it would also formally recognize their clear supremacy on the identity politics ladder. We're actually getting pretty close to that. We are actually getting pretty close to that, where the whole idea of going to court is pointless. If laws and words have different meanings according to who uttered, or even acts, in other words, if the act of rape, if some white guy rapes a white 12-year-old girl, that's a serious business. But if a gang of Pakistani Muslims in Telford or Rotherham or Rochdale or Oxford rapes a 12-year-old girl, that's all a bit more complicated, and we don't even bring that to trial. So you're right, there's actually no point, because if who you are, if your identity determines it, then we can actually cut down on a lot of court cases. I mean, it's interesting, again, it's interesting to me that the more the internal contradictions of multiculturalism become clear, the more the insanity you have whereby the state pursues ever more peripheral and irrelevant items. So, for example, today it emerged that in Scotland, I think it's in Scotland, that some guy has been found guilty because he taught his dog to do the Nazi salute, Sieg Heil. That would be a cute, stupid pet trick when David Letterman used to do that on his television show, but is actually now some kind of hate crime. I don't even know how, you know, they haven't charged the dog with doing the Sieg Heil salute. They've charged the dog's owner for training him to do the Sieg Heil salute, this dog. So, because we all know that it's but a short step from teaching your poodle or your shih tzu to go Sieg Heil, and next thing you know, it's going to be Dobermans jackbooting their way down the interstates and motorways of the world, and we will all be back in Hitler country. The state, those cases tell you something. Those cases are how it's going to be. Those stupid, and the British police are particularly stupid about this, but you have stupid policemen now all over the place as well. Although the British police, it's particularly disgraceful because this is a country which always prized the idea of free, honest, open, vigorous speech. And these pansy coppers, these pathetic pansy coppers who do nothing as you have mass gang rape for years on end and everyone knows the perpetrators, and instead the pansy coppers of the British Constabulary are all back at the police station following stupid tweeters and Facebookers, lest they say something about immigration or train their dog to do a Nazi salute. These guys should just... my friend John O'Sullivan used to write speeches for Mrs. Thatcher. He said years ago, it's a brilliant line, he said... The British police are basically the paramilitary wing of the Guardian, which is correct. They're paid to go and sit in Indian restaurants, curry houses, on a Friday night when the guys stagger in from the pub and they've had 14 pints and they decide to wash it down with a vindaloo, and they and there's plainclothes policemen at the next table sitting there as they eat their vindaloo and wash it down with another 14 pints of beer to see if they make a racist remark. These guys are pathetic, absolutely pathetic. They do nothing useful. To use an old line of mine from 10, 15, maybe even 20 years ago now, in Britain, everything is policed except crime. In Britain, everything is policed except crime, which is how Telford happens, how Rotherham happens, how Rochdale happens, how Oxford happens, and meantime, the pansy coppers of the British Constabulary are arresting people because arresting a guy who's trained his dog, Count Dankula, this Scottish YouTuber who's just been convicted of a crime because he trained his dog to go Sieg Heil. That is hilarious. Do you know, one of the reasons why the good guys won the Second World War is because we kept our sense of humour. If you're prosecuting a guy for a pet trick, you're the bloody Nazi, you stupid, idiot Scottish coppers and Scottish judges. What's shocking to me is how quickly a culture of free speech crumbles. So to the point where you have these stupid, witless hate crime statements. Well, I'll tell you another reason why they crumble. Again, and this comes down to identity politics. When Lauren Southern and Generation Identity couple who were turned away, I think one's Austrian and one American, and they were turned away, I think, at Luton Airport, coming to speak at Speaker's Corner. If you look at the, I think I saw Miss Southern's or Miss Pettibone's, the form by the UK immigration officer denying them entry. It's clearly written by someone for whom English is a second language. and who actually cannot express ideas coherently and grammatically in English. It's actually astonishing how illiterate it is. And again, that is the sign anyone who has landed at Heathrow recently will, or anyone actually who has walked around, say, Brussels recently, or actually is aware, for example, that there are members of the Belgian police who are openly Jew haters, for example. There was one, I think it was in Molenbeek, I think was some kind of security guard to the mayor of Molenbeek or whatever it was. That we're now moving into the next phase where, because of all the, again, the affirmative action way of looking at it, you have to have the security forces of the state have to reflect the balance of the state. So if you happen to come, maybe Lauren Southern's case would have gone differently if she'd come up against a Scottish or Northern Irish immigration officer. But instead, she came up against one who does not appear to speak, from the evidence of this illiterate and embarrassing form, does not appear to speak English as a first language. So even the idea of the state, the state itself is being corrupted and hollowed out by multiculturalism in that way. Alex writes, "Mark, I'm sorry that I'm repeating myself, but since today, since today's topic is macroaggression, such as what is going on in Telford and Rotherham, I can't avoid it. Essentially, what is going on there is state-sponsored genocide of the native British population by invaders. It is not only cultural genocide, but it's actually physical genocide, same as what the invaders perpetrated in their home countries. Just think about it. Those girls were gang-raped, terrorized, and some of them even murdered. What will become of them if they become old, if they survive? They were supposed to be, as they grew up, the mothers of the future generation of Britons. Essentially, what those grooming gangs have done to them is sterilize them by forced abortions, including mental and physical abuse. They never will be mothers, and the children of the Muslim grooming gangs will take over the villages and the cities where this is going on, not only by fertility of the Muslim women, but by the forced infertility of the native girls." I mean, genocide has a particular literal meaning. And, you know, I don't think it's useful diminish its meaning. In that sense, it's supposed to mean killing. It's the idea is you kill a certain mass percentage of the people from the Greek gen, which means people or the race, and it's actually Greek and Latin. Actually, it's one of those hybrid words. I think it's kaideri, which is the Latin for kill, that you have to kill a people, and you have to kill a certain proportion of the people for it to be significant genocide. That's not what's going on here. You know, and one point I do agree with that I think we have to address is that very few of these girls in these places come from intact families. They come from families which are the new kind of families, which are shifting transitional arrangements where, you know, your parents are a couple of people who got together and maybe they just hooked up for a little while, or maybe they stayed together for a couple of years and then it didn't work on, and she went off with someone and he went off with someone. And sometimes nobody wants the kid, and the kids end up in these appalling foster homes where, again, it's a racket. You get money from the government to have these kids, and as long as you're getting the money, you don't really care if the kid is out till 11 o'clock every night and comes back rather the worse for wear. None of these are towns where white working class girls grow up, where the word family has ceased to exist. And these are girls growing up in transient households where the adults have continuously shifting and transient relationships. I said in America Alone that Islam in that sense is an opportunist infection. It would not have been possible for what goes on in Telford or Rotherham to occur if these girls were in intact families where their biological father was the guy raising them. I don't think there's any great strategy to make them infertile. You don't have to make them, these girls, infertile. You look at who's getting the abortions in the United Kingdom, and you look at who's filling the maternity wards in the United Kingdom, and the answer is completely obvious. Essentially, the state and the Muslim gangs have the same view of these girls, that they're working class, white trash, and are worthless. As I said last year when I met some of them in Rotherham, and I met a lot of them, and some of them are actually very sharp, witty, perceptive, have a certain perspective on the hell of their lives. They're all damaged. As I said, some are perceptive and understand they're damaged by what has happened, but they have a certain sort of inherent sharpness and a native wit and intelligence, and they have a certain perspective on themselves. And one point they well understand is that they are valueless to everybody. Nobody cares about them. To the coppers and the social workers and even judges and politicians and media, they're packy shaggers. You know, in other words, they're just they're white slags, as the Muslim gangs call them. That they are people who are barely human. They're like subhuman animals, and so they've no interest to the British media. And at the same time, the Muslim gangs understand that these girls have grown up in the very libertine British culture of the last 30, 40, 50 years. You know, honk if you bonk, as the bumper sticker used to say. A shagadelic, all the rest of it. You know, shagging like minxes, or whatever it was Austin Powers used to say. Sex, 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 sex. Bonk, 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 crazy. And that's all they do, and that's what. And like, you're going to marry a nice Muslima, and maybe she's your first, like in Bradford, she's your first cousin from back in Pakistan. 75% of the Pakistani British marriages in the town of Bradford. You're going to marry your first cousin, and she's nice. And she makes a lovely wife, and she doesn't go out except with you, and she is covered from head to toe whenever she leaves the house, and she's a nice, modest, respectable Muslima who is the perfect mother for your children. But you've grown up with one foot in the honk if you bonk Brit sex-crazed libertine culture too, and you'd like to be getting a little bit extra, and you can't ask the nice, modest Muslima for that, so you go to the white slags, the packy shaggers, and they'll do anything for you. And so, again, that's an example of how the libertinism is a conditional, is a transitional phase. In the end, all societies require some kind of structure. If you're lucky, the libertinism of Regency England was followed by Victorian values. So if you're lucky, your libertinism, the pendulum swings, and you have a slightly demure phase of your own culture. If you screw things up as comprehensively as the Western world is doing right now, your hyper-libertinism, which is what exists in Britain and Europe and other places, the controlling, generally religious culture that is going to follow will not be your own. It will be something alien, something new, something different. And Islam understands that. And in the meantime, it looks on, if you're a Muslim guy on the streets of Rotherham or Telford, the white slags, as you see them, are an opportunity. They're girls with no men in their lives who often are looking for some kind of father figure or male authority figure in their lives. And some of these Muslim men, who are often far more charming than the beer-gutted local lads, offer themselves and provide some structure for your life. These are what they call the lover boys in the Netherlands. It's a slightly different. They're not like these brutal gang rape things in Telford and Rotherham. They're sort of more charming. But in each case, you do discern that the Muslims understand something that left-wing libertines don't, that the present phase is merely a transitional phase and something other comes along. Mike writes, Mark, isn't the situation in the UK where the police won't do their jobs a new best advert for Second Amendment rights? I think that's true. As I said, I do think the problem actually is more basic than that in these towns, because you have broken families. And broken families basically lead to the victimization of girls. And you have categories of crimes that didn't exist 50 years ago. Which we have here in the United States too. For example, girls who whose mothers leave the father of the girl, take up with a boyfriend, then drift with another boyfriend. And eventually the girl's 12, 13, and she's looking rather hotter than her haggard mother is. And this month's boyfriend starts takes a liking to the daughter. And so you have a whole category of crime, which is the sexual abuse of girls by the mother's transient boyfriend, that was basically all but unknown 50, 60 years ago. That's common in the United Kingdom and the United States. But the Second Amendment point is good, is in the broader sense. What we are seeing on both continents, I think, is that when you mortgage your security to the state screws you over. That's true in the Parkland shooting, which again is tied to identity politics, in that basically everybody is incentivized to downplay apparent behavior by certain identity groups. So because this guy's name was Cruz, and he spelt Nicholas funny, they downplayed it because the school districts are incentivized to lower the numbers of certain identity groups that are in their juvenile delinquent statistics. So everyone knows the kind of guy he is, but nobody does anything until he kills people. And then he kills a bunch of people, and everyone is doing the new Florida dance craze, the Broward County Crouch. You can do it behind any motor vehicle. There'll probably be a few Broward County deputies doing it right now. And nobody goes in until the guy's finished killing everybody. Likewise, what you see in the streets of Swedish and German and other European cities, where you Austrian city, Vienna, where you have mayors and police chiefs advising women not to go out at night, even in groups. They're telling you that you've mortgaged all your security to the state, and the state isn't there for you. One of the horrifying statistics that I brought up at the Monk debate was a category of crime that didn't really exist, certainly not on the scale it does, gang rape in public places. And I reeled off a whole list of these public places, not just parks, but railway stations. I traveled all over Europe, and actually, whether it was in Finland or whether it was in Germany, or whether it was in Belgium, I spoke to girls and their parents and their neighbors about sex attacks on the way home from on roads that are all called basically Station Street, Railway Lane, whatever they are. They're the 10-minute walk home from the station to the house where these girls are gang raped. It's like a whole, that in itself is a subgenre of crime. Actually, it happened in Cologne, the New Year's Eve thing, all on the trains and on the main railway terminus. So we're having attacked. You can be attacked in the most public place. You can be sexually assaulted in the most public place in these European cities. And they know that nothing, and these gangs know that nothing will be done. Nothing will be done. And I think what these cases in America teach, alongside what is happening in Europe, is that you cannot mortgage your security to the state. Mark, George Pereira writes, Mark, in the Boston area, we have another Canadian turned American who speaks much the same as you and other Americans about illegal immigration and the corrosive effect it has on society in general. Yet when you, and in this case I mean you, speak about illegal immigration and the evils that immigration wreaks on America and the American people, you're attacked and told you ought to go back to Canada. And if you don't want to go voluntarily, you ought to be run out on a rail. I don't understand this. I can't wrap my head about the sentiment. Why is the legal Mark Stein doing the job American journalists refuse to do the problem, while the illegal Jose preying on the American people and American generosity, the next saint? Because it's population replacement, George. It's the, they actually want the exotic other. I don't, I employ people in the United States, you know, and I said to them, like I came down into my office one morning, and I found a couple of my employees, you know, moaning and whining about what a tyrannical boss I am when I walked into the office. And I said, you know, well, tough. I'm the foreigner. And you guys need foreigners to come here to employ Americans to do the jobs that foreigners won't do. That's the function I fulfill in my corner of New Hampshire. And that isn't what illegal immigration is about. Because generally speaking, that kind of immigration, that's individual immigration. And I've got no problem with individual immigration. I think someone who can support himself, can start a business, can employ people. I think generally speaking, immigration systems around the world should accord a certain amount of deference to him. He's not going to change anything. Yes, he can be in New Hampshire for 30 bloody years and he still talks like he got off the boat yesterday, and it annoys when he's gassing up at the general store. It creeps out the North Country Yankee Highlanders to have to listen to his effete foreign vowels. But those are like peripheral problems. It's not it's mass immigration. Mass unskilled immigration is transformative. And that's precisely why leftist elites want it, because it's the absolute logical endpoint of the transformation they plan for society. If you believe, as they do, that straight, cis, white, male culture has been responsible for all the evils of the planet, then it is entirely logical to want as few straight, cis, white guys as possible. And the best way to do that is to import vast numbers of people who are not that from somewhere else. And that actually has a certain ruthless logic about it in the Bertolt Brechtian sense of electing a new people. That is exactly what is going on. It's purposeful. And a Swiss banker who decides to open up a branch in Portland, Maine, of his Swiss bank, doesn't offer anything like the same kind of frisson of actually engaging in the wholesale civilizational replacement. And there's a tragedy about this too, which I've remarked on before as well, that you don't just lose your future, you lose your past. London has the rate of population increase since Tony Blair became Prime Minister has been unprecedented in the United Kingdom. And in London in particular, London gets less English with every year. And everyone thinks, oh, that's great. That's great. There are losses there too. London is the biggest theatre city in the world. It has an extraordinary range of plays and musicals and all concerts and all kinds of the rest of it. There will be none of that. The more it becomes an impoverished Islamic city, you can kiss goodbye to West End Theatre. You can kiss goodbye to chamber music recitals at the Wigmore Hall, because that's all alien. And so that's the real tragedy for what is happening to Western civilization at the moment, is not just that you lose your future, but that you lose your past. And eventually, as people walk around the cities and all the rest of it, apart from, you know, architecture, there will actually be no signs that you were ever there. And that's the tragedy. That's the tragedy of that. Alan Miller writes, Mark, you have now used the expression super microaggression several times. Well, clearly you are referring to the new nanoaggressions. However, what worries me now is that I see where this is going. The next tranche of aggressions will be called quantum aggressions. Then, like Schrodinger's cat, merely by asking if an action is a quantum aggression, you will have established that it is and are already guilty of triggering it. Even more frightening, as with the electron, these aggressions will not exist at a specific point, but will exist everywhere, but with varying degrees of probability. Yes, it's like splitting the atom, isn't it? It's like eventually we will, you're right, we'll have nano aggressions, quantum aggressions, and then it will, and then we they're all out there, you know. They're going to be, and that's the whole thing too. It's going to be, before I forget, can't just talk. Somebody asked me about Kinder Eggs, and they said they'd seen Kinder Eggs on TV. This isn't a Kinder Egg. You know me, Kinder Eggs, I believe Kinder Eggs are legal everywhere on the planet. When I'm with my kids, trying to bring them across the border from Canada, the control freak customs and border protection people go through the vehicle to see if you've got Kinder Eggs over there. Because Kinder Eggs have chocolate. It's a chocolate egg with what the United States government has declared a non-nutritive embed. And you can't have a non-nutritive embed in a chocolate egg. So they've introduced Kinder Eggs, which are one of the great glories of the planet. You eat the chocolate, and then the non-nutritive embed, as it's known in America, is what we call on the rest of the planet a toy. And so the children play with the toy, but the control freaks of Customs and Border Protection seize the Kinder Egg, and like my kid said. He was told he couldn't have the Kinder Egg because it's dangerous. He might choke on the non-nutritive embed. So my kid, Ralph, said to the Gauleiter of the state, well, in that case, could you open up the egg and remove the non-nutritive embed, and then I'll eat the chocolate egg and you can give me the non-nutritive embed, the toy, and then I can go back and play with the toy, having eaten the chocolate. And the customs officer warned him that he was disrespecting the process. He was like, you know, one more answer away from Gitmo. I'd never have heard from the kid again, which would have been great, believe me. They've now introduced some phony baloney Kinder Egg just for Americans. It's called a Kinder Joy. And it is, and it's half a chocolate egg. You open it up, it's two separate things. There's a plastic container with the stupid toy in on one half, and then half a chocolate egg. It's not a Kinder Egg. It's some pansified Kinder Egg that Americans can't be trusted with Kinder Eggs, like Canadians, Germans, Saudis, all the rest of them. They can be trusted with a Kinder Egg. What kind of generation of Americans are we raising if they can't even handle a non-nutritive embed in a chocolate egg? So don't go for this Kinder Joy. A reader wrote to me and called it a hollow victory. And that's right. It's half a hollow chocolate egg and then some plastic thing. It's ruined it. And that's the other thing about this. That's the other thing about these guys. They spoil all the fun. They spoil all the fun. The toy is not a great toy. You know, it's not like an iPhone. It's just some stupid plastic toy. So it's only fun because it's in the chocolate egg. It's like sixpences in Christmas puddings, which are also non-nutritive embeds. So you have the crappy toy is only fun because you bite into the chocolate to discover what it is. And they've taken away the fun. They've taken away the fun, which is what they do. And I'm sorry if I was shouting, but remember, if you're from the University of California, Santa Cruz, that when a cis straight white male is shouting, you can say, what the hell are you raising your voice for? Why don't you hold it down a bit? But if a black man is shouting, you're not allowed to say that because then you will be committing a hate crime. So feel free to yell at me to turn it down a bit. Jill Felsen writes, hi, Mark. Love the voice of the lady who does your intros for this and for the audiobooks. Your stuff is always very interesting anyway, but she makes it sound even better. Just pass along the compliment. Thanks. I'm not going to do that. Because, in fact, she is a sub-minimum wage Venezuelan peasant that I keep chained in the basement just because it's a lot cheaper than hiring somebody from Vermont and New Hampshire. But thanks for that, Jill. It's always good to know that it's all downhill after the intro. And it certainly is. It certainly is. You're not the only one. You know who liked her voice, Jill? You're in good company here. Tim Rice, the lyricist of The Lion King and Aladdin and Evita and Jesus Christ Superstar and all that. Tim likes her voice too, so you're in good company there, Jill. That is it from us. It is 5 p.m. Daylight Savings Time in North America. That means it's 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, wherever you are around the planet. Thanks for dialing us up, and we'll see you next time.